more useful for us today, a small group and a small amount of time. I understand that we'll probably talk together till close to 1 o'clock. If any of you need to leave, why, of course, leave. I would like to do my thing and then give us plenty of opportunity to talk together, to dialogue. However, if as I go along talking, there's something you don't understand about what I'm saying, I'd like for you to stop me right then and ask me in terms of clarification. I guess if we want to get into discussion, I would prefer that that might wait until the end, but I wouldn't want to be really firm about that. I think we can pick up at point C under number one, a Christian approach to understanding alcohol and alcoholism. Point C says that there are uses and misuses of alcohol. I think the place we need to begin at is to say, I assumed it's all right for me to sit here. Yeah. The place to begin is to say that ethyl alcohol is a drug. I think that most people don't perceive that. That is not part of their understanding. That ethyl alcohol is a drug, and that it is a drug that depresses the central nervous system. Therefore, it is an anesthetic type of drug in the same category with the barbiturate kinds of drugs or other kinds of downers. What about drinking? Many people decide not to drink. I think that perhaps as Missouri Synod Lutherans, we don't think about that possibility too often, unless you're a pastor or you may belong to a little group of Norwegians or whoever those Scandinavian Lutherans are who don't drink. But today we're really saying to one another, it's okay not to drink. It's quite possible for a person, for various reasons, to decide not to use beverage alcohol, just as people decide not to smoke. You may make that decision for religious reasons, you may make that decision for health reasons, but whatever, it's a possibility, and we need to respect, I think, that decision on the part of people. I think it's very difficult for us to respect that decision. If we're having a party, if we're having dinner guests, sometimes we can be very insistent that people drink with us. And we need to learn not to be insistent, but to offer all optional beverages for people too. We say, and I think very rightly, that there is an appropriate use of alcohol. I believe that's the way we reflect upon sacred scripture, that alcohol, like many other things that God gives us, is a good gift and may be appropriately and joyfully used, and of course we use it sacramentally, so it's very much a part of our worship life. It's at the very heart and center of our Christian life. Number three, the truth of the matter is that some people, when they drink, have problems with their drinking. Not everybody who drinks, drinks well. Not everybody who drinks has a good experience of drinking. Some people, when they drink, have automobile accidents, they get into fights, they become involved in sexual behavior that they might not ordinarily become involved in. They have problems because of the way they drink. But I'm most interested in number four, in the statement that says, some people drink and for various reasons become alcoholic persons. I want to talk a little bit about a definition of alcoholism with you. And that's not an easy thing to do. I think probably we can say that it's like a two-sided coin, and I will give you one definition and I'll flip it over and give you the other. The first definition of alcoholism is something like this. If a person begins consistently to get into difficulty in one or more areas of their life because of their use of beverage alcohol, they are probably an alcoholic person. They probably have the illness of alcoholism. You know, for example, if a person's having problems driving the car and having automobile accidents, health problems, money problems, job problems, problems with the family relationships, and these seem to intensify and increase and become consistent, then we would say that that person is, in all likelihood, an alcoholic person, has become addicted to ethyl alcohol and has entered in to the whole progression of the illness. Okay. The other side of the coin is the definition I really prefer, but it's a bit more difficult to perceive. And that is that an alcoholic person is a person who cannot consistently refrain from drinking, and when he or she begins to drink, cannot normally stop until he or she is intoxicated. Now, I think I want to say, be careful. A lot of alcoholics can decide by sheer guts not to drink for a long time and say, see, I don't have any drinking problems. No problem with booze and me. I haven't had anything to drink for 2 weeks, for 1 month, for 6 weeks, for 2 months, for 3 months. I would say that's very difficult for an alcoholic to do, and he or she's probably pretty dadgum grouchy during that period of time and unhappy and miserable. But the more important kind of thing there is what happens when that person begins to drink. Because normally, that person will not be able to take one or two drinks and stop. That person cannot drink within intention anymore. That person drinks most of the time, if not all of the time, to the point of intoxication. So at the very heart and center of alcoholism, then, the phrase is loss of control. And there must be about 12 million people, or maybe more, in our country who have the illness of alcoholism. They have lost control over their use of beverage alcohol. That makes it a pretty serious illness. And if you say that there are at least four other people involved with that person in that illness, a husband, a wife, children, mother, and father, and begin multiplying that, there are an awful lot of people today who are entangled in the whole web of alcoholism. Okay. Do I seem to be clear to this point about what I'm saying? Okay, then we'll go on to D. What I would like for you to see is that alcoholism is a very specific kind of illness. It is not like any other. Diabetes is a specific kind of illness. So is alcoholism. And it is a progressive illness, and it is a fatal illness unless there's recovery. Number one, I want to come back to loss of control. There's an awful lot of debate about whether alcoholism is an illness. And theologians like us really get heavy into that debate, and it's very easy for us to say, you know, alcoholism is a matter of sin, and it is a matter of sinfulness. And it is. I have no doubt about that, that alcoholism is the result of our sinful human condition, our alienation from God. But it just isn't that simple. You just can't say to a person, there may be exceptions, I'm going to be careful. I don't believe that generally you can say to a person, hey, shape up, turn on your willpower, rev up your faith, and stop drinking. The illness is bigger than that. And I believe that as Christians, we can understand that. And we can understand that better than most people can understand that. Because we can understand the process of non-freedom. If there's anybody in the whole world who understands enslavement, we ought to be able to understand how sin enslaves human beings. It kind of interests me, and I don't know where I would take this if you ask me to take it. I don't know where you'd take it if I ask you to. But it kind of interests me that when Jesus did his ministry among people, there were some people he healed. They were blind and deaf. They couldn't speak. They were lame. And he did that by touch, by speaking a word. But there were some other people that Jesus ran into. And it was a different kind of thing. He had to do something very special to free these people up from an enslavement, from a demonic enslavement, so that they could become responsible for their own lives. And Scripture talks about those people as being demon-possessed and Jesus performing exorcism, casting out the devil. Now, I want you to be careful. I'm not saying here that alcoholic people are demon-possessed and that the rite of exorcism will do them. What I'm saying here is that it is interesting to note that Jesus did find enslaved people and he dealt with them in a different way than he dealt with people with other illnesses to enable them once again to take charge of their lives and to become responsible human beings under his lordship. So, I don't know whether you're comfortable with the illness concept or not. I'm not too comfortable with the word disease, and you haven't heard me use it yet. Many of my colleagues are very comfortable with that word, and depends, I suppose, on how you define it. But I guess I would ask you to look at alcoholism as an illness, at least in seeing that it is a matter of enslavement, that this human being is out of control and needs whatever help other human beings, especially Christian human beings, can bring to help this individual be back in control again. In fact, I think that's what our big business is, bringing the life and power of God in Jesus Christ to human beings so that they can have the resources of life and take charge of their lives and become responsible human beings under the lordship of Jesus Christ. So what we learn here in alcoholism helps us for all of life, by the way. My whole pastoral care approach has been tremendously enhanced by my study of alcoholism and my work in the field. Okay. Number two, we'll get into some more religious stuff right away here now. The experience of the alcoholic person in this state of enslavement is that the pleasure of the drinking experience is greater than the pain. Now, there's got to be some pain. When you're bombed out of your mind, most of the time, there have got to be problems. But the pleasure of that. About 2 years while I worked in the field of alcoholism, I really had a super experience that I want to share with you. I got to work in a Roman Catholic therapeutic community where priests and brothers were recovering from alcoholism, and where they came for 3 to 4 months after they were out of hospital treatment. And it was a super place. But there, as men really spoke straight to me, I began to realize some things about alcohol by John. Thank you. That I hadn't realized before, and that is that some people really get a super experience out of booze. I don't. I drink a couple of drinks, and I'm likely to crawl off in the corner and go to sleep. And that's kind of a good safety mechanism for me, because it means as long as that works, unless somebody pours it down my throat, and that's not likely, I'm probably not going to become an alcoholic. Although, anybody who drinks runs that danger, because 1 out of every 10 or 12 people who use beverage alcohol in any way become alcoholics. And we have no idea why. We really don't understand why. Okay, but maybe here is a good point to say that this experience that alcoholic people have is a kind of religious experience. You should hear them describe it. It's an experience in which they feel really good about themselves. They feel real close and intimate with other people. They feel they're sitting on top of the world. And God is just about the biggest buddy around. And so their relational or religious needs are met. The needs to feel good about self, to feel good about other people, to feel good about God, to feel good about the world, they are met. And Howard Kleinbell, in his book, maybe some of you know that book, Understanding and Counseling the Alcoholic Through Religion and Psychology, makes the big point that drinking for the alcoholic is a pseudo-religious experience. That the religious needs of the person are met. It's a false thing, it's a temporary thing, but are met by beverage alcohol. Okay, maybe we could just digress here just a minute and say, okay, if that's true, how do people become alcoholics? I don't think people become alcoholics for the same reason. I think some people become alcoholics because alcohol means more to them, and it meets their needs, their deep inner needs, and they get more and more into it, and they become addicted, and they get into the illness of alcoholism and its progression. I think other people just kind of stumble into it accidentally. You know, they drink, and for some reason, all of a sudden, they're addicted. But the end result is the same, because as soon as you get into the thing, there are needs, and the needs, in turn, are met by alcohol. You know, St. Paul really knew what he was talking about when he said, no one who depends on alcohol can be very tight with the kingdom of God. My translation, or mistranslation, as it may be. But it makes sense. If people find God in the bottle rather than in the kingdom of God within them, the two become mutually exclusive. And you're finding your religious needs in alcohol, then God's being pushed out. For this reason, most alcoholic persons do drop out of church. Somebody has suggested that probably most of the delinquent members in our congregations have drinking problems. That may be an oversimplification, But it may be something that needs to be looked at very carefully, very seriously. Okay. If we go on down, remembering that the pleasure of this experience is greater than the pain, we can begin to understand what I say next. That a part of this illness is the use of splendid defense mechanisms. You know, it's for real. This guy isn't being a jerk. This gal isn't being deceptive. They aren't just, you know, being difficult. Part of the illness is to practice denial. Denial saying, I don't have any drinking problem. What are you talking about? I don't have any drinking problem. Or projection in the sense that, yeah, maybe I do drink a little bit too much sometimes, but it's my wife's fault. If you had that nagging wife I've got, if you've got those unruly, disobedient, disrespectful kids I've got, if you've got that unreasonable, demanding boss I've got, if you've got that neighbor who already always borrows my lawnmower and breaks it up and doesn't repair it when he brings it, you drink too. Our rationalization just simply saying, I don't drink any more than anybody else drinks. Why don't you stop down at the tavern some afternoon after work with me and you'll see that Jim and George and Mary and Barb drink just as much as I do. And so here we go. And this is a part of the illness. Now, I think we need to ask, why is it a part of the illness? Well, I think it makes sense. You see, the alcoholic person sometimes gets it together. And he says, boy, there's something different about my drinking. You know, there's something different. I must be a bad person. Or maybe I'm crazy. And none of us wants to think that we're either bad or crazy. So up shoot the defense mechanisms, and the defense system goes to work, and we're able to push it away and handle it a while with some denial, projection, rationalization, or whatever. The illness is progressive. Here is the Jelinek chart on alcoholism. Wow, do we know a lot about alcoholism. Here's kind of the way down. But I want to make clear as you look at this chart that the way down doesn't mean that a person has to get all the way down to the bottom to decide to recover. A person can recover at any point and move across. This is called the Jelinek chart or the Valley chart. The point about this is that we know enough about alcoholism that we know how it progresses. There are phases and steps. Now, maybe not everybody goes through all the steps or in exactly the same way. But we know enough about it to be able to identify it, and we know pretty well what's going to happen to people as this illness begins to destroy their life. Now, this is kind of an exciting part about this illness for a theologian, for a pastor, for people like you and me. If you want to see the biblical understanding of illness working itself out in the human life, here you can see it. That the human being is unitary. Maybe body, mind, spirit, soul, say it whichever way you want, but they're all interrelated. Here you can see an illness that takes its toll on the whole person, destructive of the body, liver, pancreas, stomach, brain, nervous system, the mind, the spiritual life. All of the relationships of life begin to deteriorate, the person's self-esteem, his relationship and fellowship with other human beings, his relationship with God, his whole understanding of his place in the world, and his feeling toward it. Everything simply begins to fall apart. There's no cure for this illness that we've been able to find. There are people who say they found it. We don't believe that. We, meaning I don't believe it, and the people I've worked with, that there is a way of recovery. An individual stops drinking and puts their life together again in constructive ways without beverage alcohol. Number five is maybe one of the most important sentences I can give you. It is only when the pain of the alcoholic drinking becomes greater than the pleasure that the alcoholic can be open to help or the alcoholic can despair. That's just the way it is. As I see it, if you want to put it in terms of law and gospel, with the alcoholic, and maybe with people in many circumstances of life, you can quarrel with me if you want, that's okay. The proclamation of the law is not enough. they must also have an in-life, an in-house, critical experience of the law. It has to become an existential, in-existence kind of thing. And I think that's what happens here. Now you'll say, does it really have to get that bad? If you've worked with alcoholics at all, there's one thing you'll find out. These people can be having all kinds of problems, right? Money problems, health problems, family problems, job problems over here. And they can be drinking over here, and they do not see the relationship. It's east is east and west is west, and you just have all kinds of trouble getting it together. The problems are somebody else's problems. They are not mine, and they are not my drinking. So the pain of the drinking has to become greater than the pleasure, and the alcoholic will be ready to do something to change. Or, if the alcoholic has not been prepared by a proper kind of care, will then despair. Just give up, commit suicide, or drink himself to death. And the rate of suicide among male alcoholics is very great. And I notice that I keep saying he and him, but I guess you need to know, it's important for me to tell you, that there may be as many women alcoholics as there are men today. That figure we're not really sure of because they're so closeted and hidden and protected by their husbands. I'm going to digress at point six just to tell you something about teenage drinking that I think will be important to you. I have a friend in St. Louis by the name of Dr. David Ohms, who is a psychiatrist who works in the field of alcoholism. And generally speaking, I do not recommend a psychiatrist to work with a person who is alcoholic. I do not see alcoholism as a psychiatric illness. Did you hear me? I say that again. Alcoholics may sometimes be psychotic or have psychiatric illnesses of that provide the first diagnosis. Then that's a different ballgame. But most alcoholics, they have some psychiatric problems as a result of their alcoholism, but their primary diagnosis is alcoholism, and they are not to be treated according to the psychiatric model. In fact, most psychiatrists, I don't believe, understand anything about alcoholism. Most doctors don't, and I'm not trying to put them down. It's the honest to goodness truth. Anyway, David Ohms knows about alcoholism. And he did a little study among some high school kids out in St. Louis County, out west. And, of course, as you might expect, he found out that a lot of kids are drinking. But what he found out was what the drinking is all about for them, and that frightened him. I think when I was a kid, we drank to have a good time. We drank to be part of the crowd. We drank to let everybody know how tough we were. But what he discovered is that young people today are drinking alone, drinking to relieve tension, drinking with the purpose of getting intoxicated and having that feeling of euphoria. And that frightened David because, said he, those are the characteristics of alcoholism, not just plain drinking. There's something really sick about drinking alone. Now, if you've ever drank alone, don't fall apart right here now. That's not where I'm coming from. But, you know, to drink alone, to drink to relieve tension, and to drink to become intoxicated, that, you know, that's bad news. I'm going to start talking about pastoral care or a Christian approach now. I think one of our jobs is learn to identify alcoholism as early as we can for ourselves. Now, it won't do me much good to identify your alcoholism and come over and say, I have decided you're an alcoholic. You know, what you'll probably do is punch me in the nose if I live that long. Even if you didn't punch me in the nose, it probably wouldn't do any good. I would need to convince you of that. But it will be important for me to know that so I can begin to do some things for you that are helpful. Let me tell you, gang, I spent almost 9 years working in the field of alcoholism, and when I went back into the parish, I couldn't see it. Now, if I couldn't see it, of course, there maybe was another factor there. When I went into the parish, I didn't want the members of the congregation to think that all they were going to hear from me was drinking and alcoholism and drugs and drug dependency and drug addiction, so I really backed off. And I just said to people, I have some expertise in this. If you want my help, you know, seek me out. And it's happened. I didn't pay attention. And I want you to pay attention. People would come to me and they'd be, you know, reciting their problems and their difficulties. And I didn't even think to ask, is there any drinking problem here? Jack, tell me a little bit about your drinking. You know, how do you drink or marry? I do that now. Maybe not right off the bat, but it isn't long down the road that I check that out. And I often recheck it because I'm not pleased with what I did for almost a year. And as a result of that, didn't help some people as well as I could have helped them, and certainly not as early as I could. So you're making the diagnosis, not to lay it on them. You're making a tentative diagnosis for yourself so that you can be helpful to them in your approach. What we need to do, and probably this isn't just for alcoholic persons, it's in our parishes, wherever we have opportunity, is to help people understand the nature of this illness and how it's treated, what it's all about. And while I know that St. Paul meant something either more specific or different, his words certainly helped me here speak the truth in love. Now, I realize that to speak the truth in love, you got to have a close relationship with somebody. In his book, Howard Kleinbell says the only time you intervene in the life of an alcoholic is when their life is in danger or somebody else's life is in danger, then you just barrel right in. You know, you're probably going to destroy the relationship you have with that person, but that's important. Or, he says, when you have a close personal relationship with that person, then you can speak the truth. My hunch is that as pastors, we can develop those kinds of relationships, and that puts us in a very advantageous position. I wish I had more time just to talk about this whole concept, because I believe that we have garbage in our heads, and I see it in me and in the congregation all the time, that says we can't tell the truth to each other. We can't caringly say things to each other like, I'm kind of concerned about your drinking, or your sermons haven't been all that helpful to me. That we've got to say that to other people, or we've got to be underhanded, or we've got to hurt, or we've got to be devious. That's really a lot of garbage. I think that as long as we go at each other caringly and lovingly, we can say an awful lot of the truth. See, I want to hurry up because I want to give you some opportunity, and I'm not doing that well. One of the toughest things we have to do is to so practice Christian love as to allow the alcoholic person to experience the painful consequences of the drinking behavior. That's, you know, there are wives who say, I can't do that, I love him. I say, you will do it because you love him. That's what Christian love is all about. It's tough. It's determined to help the other person. It is not primarily a thing of feelings or doing what the other person wants. It's doing good for the other person. Doing that at a point of sacrifice, at a point of self-hurt, you're going to have to do it. That's the only way the person's going to recover. Family members have a way of supporting the drinking of the alcoholic, helping the alcoholic person drink. Now, footnote, most of the time it isn't going to be the alcoholic we come into contact with, it's going to be the spouse. And so this is important for us to help that spouse to detach from the painful consequences of the alcoholic's drinking, and at the same time to be able to allow that person to suffer. Now, that doesn't mean you go away. You say something like this, George, you know, I love you and you're important to me, but I believe you have an illness and it's called alcoholism. There's treatment for it, and I want you to go get treatment for it. And if you don't, I think you're going to destroy yourself and our whole family relationship. And that's all you say. Let George argue and fuss and cuss all he wants to. That's all you say. You just drop it there and just keep cool. You have to keep dealing with the reality time and time again. It is very important for me, at least, and I think for you, to be sure that the family members get to the spouse gets involved in Al-Anon, which is the self-help group for the spouse, to learn to detach themselves from the painful consequences of the alcoholic person's drinking and to have a happy life of their own. And there's Alateen, of course, for the children, and I think it's very important. And sometimes it's just as hard to get those people into Al-Anon as it is to get the alcoholic into AA. It really is. You got to really push and shove and keep after it. E. Our ultimate goal is to help the alcoholic receive treatment for alcoholism. Most alcoholics I know have recovered the AA way. AA is only partial, but it works in that it has some of the Christian dynamic involved in it, and if the founders had had their way, it would have been Christ-centered. But they said, hey, we've got to make this treatment program available to everybody. The Council on Alcoholism in Communities provides help, and in almost every community today, there are alcoholism treatment centers or hospitals. Centers solely for the treatment of alcoholism. Over on the other side of the river where I come from, they throw the alcoholics in the psychiatric unit at St. Anthony's Hospital and load them down with major tranquilizers. Melaril, Thorazine, in addition to other sedative kinds of drugs. You know, I would like to take that doctor and strangle him, because he isn't helping any alcoholics recover. He really isn't. The thing is, people know that and can't seem to do anything about it. Well, as a pastoral care kind of person, you aren't going to run away from that. If the person goes into treatment or into AA, our job is to stay there being supportive and caring every step of the way. Our job is to see to it that the Christian community is a caring, accepting, forgiving, supportive community. We have not been very good to alcoholics in our congregation. I don't usually say that much in that short period of time, so I'm halfway pleased with myself. What would you like to talk about?
Concerning the pain therapy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've heard a district investor one time, they were counseling wives how to not cover up for the alcoholic, don't make it easy for them. Mm. One person even said that you separate from one case. Is there limits to how far we go? Because we could break off the family by not covering up for the alcoholic.
Yeah. Okay, two comments. First of all, be sure that we help spouses not make any threats that they aren't willing to back up. You don't go around saying, unless you get treatment, I'm going to leave you or I'm going to divorce you. Unless the person has really thought that through and is ready to do it, because if you say you're going to do it and you don't do it, you've really lost your clout. You've gone down the drain. I don't really have the answer to that. You know, I just realized that in some cases it may mean separation, but the goal is always toward recovery, or it may mean divorce, and the goal is toward recovery. In my congregation, there's a young couple. The boy isn't even 30 yet. Really tremendous couple. He's a very young alcoholic. The age is getting younger now, as we know. I haven't told you that, but it is. They've been married and divorced, and it looked like he had handles on his alcoholism and just recently got their second divorce. But I don't think she's given up the hope that the whole trauma of that is going to send him into treatment and he's going to get well and they're still going to have a good marriage. It's very difficult. You know, it really is. It's so difficult. Because you have to ask about the good of the alcoholic and the good of the family. Everybody gets sick. Everybody gets crazy. You're bound to. The roles are mixed up and confused. So that's where your pastoral care judgment will really have to work for you. Yeah.
A lot of different people on the streets
have
the high alcohol,
yeah,
sort of a degree.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is sort of a, not a, like a built-in disability or something on that line. I know you said some stumble into it, but others just really meet their needs and they already, are you saying there's sort of the way the person medically or however else may perhaps sort of a built-in?
We don't really know. That's the honest truth, you know. We don't really know yet whether some people process ethyl alcohol different biochemically and become addicted, or whether with some people it's more of an emotional thing. The studies just haven't figured that out. Yeah.
Yes, I guess I have a couple of questions.
Yeah.
number five, when the pain of alcohol or drinking becomes greater than the pleasure, you think that you may be open to help. But what if the pain has become greater, but the greater pain only makes them go even more towards the alcohol? A kind of, that's what it goes for solace. And it's a vicious cycle. How can one break that?
Well, I think that's moved to despair then. I think that person somehow or another didn't, the people around that person were not able to do whatever things needed to be done to cause that person to believe that there was something better. On the other hand, I want to be careful about that, because I don't want to I don't want to lay a lot of responsibility on other people for other people's drinking. When I was installed into this business, Dr. Cease did the sermon, and he knew me very well. And this was back in 68, and he looked down the pulpit and he said to me, "The hardest thing in this whole business for you, Charles, is going to be to watch some people die from their alcoholism, and there isn't going to be anything you can do about it, because they are determined to die." And he was right. So, you know, what I say to the wife and the kids in an alcoholic's family is, you aren't responsible for that alcoholism, and you aren't responsible for that person stopping drinking. There are some things you can do for yourself and hopefully to help that person. Okay?
Yes, I have another question on the AA. What if a person has gone to AA for a while, seen that made progress, but then decided rationally, and their way of thinking rationally decided, will not go any longer to AA and will continue drinking?
Yeah, that
what
person.
Can you do then?
What can you do then? You go, you're right back where you were. You're back to square one, aren't you? That person is going to have to go through that painful experience again.
It is. But it seems like the person will go hit the bottom and then bounce up, go to AA, and seem to make very well progress, but then go all the way back.
Yeah, but sometimes that isn't altogether bad. Oftentimes alcoholics have to drink again. Have to drink. You know what I'm saying. Have to drink again to see they really are alcoholics. After a period of time, they begin to say, "Oh, I can handle my booze." You know, so it can be a positive thing, right?
Yeah. There's a drug that's used. It's apparently a thing to a person very sick. If you drink alcohol, you have this drug in your system.
And abuse.
Is that effective?
It's effective as long as the person takes the drug. You know, but if an alcoholic really wants to drink, they get that all craftily and sneakily planned, and, you know, I won't take it today, and I'll be able to go off and drink on Friday. Yeah. But the thing that's good about it makes the decision to drink a one-time thing every day. You know, if I take that pill, I've made the decision that day not to drink. If I don't take the pill, then I might have to make it 100 times. So that's the positive effect of it.
Sometimes hear concern about the alcoholic coming to the communion table.
Mm-hmm.
How do you handle it?
Different strokes for different folks. There are some alcoholic persons I know who have absolutely no problem with receiving the consecrated wine. There are others that prefer grape juice. And I guess I feel comfortable enough using grape juice. The only person that I use that for in my congregation, by the way, is not an alcoholic, but a woman who has an allergy to wine. Not, you know, she breaks out. And it's either grape juice or nothing. And that's the pastoral decision that I've made. Now, there are some people who would say an alcoholic should not receive wine at Holy Communion. But I do have alcoholic friends who are able to handle that. So you'll have to make that.
Possible that one small portion of wine could trigger a whole new cycle.
Yeah. I have a friend in the field of medicine who insists that it can. You know, chemically. Actually, it could chemically do it. So I'm very careful to process that out with an alcoholic, as you can imagine.
My question deals with the role of the pastor.
Yeah.
Or the pastor doing something like that, whether or not the community alcoholic.
You mean a practicing alcoholic or a recovered alcoholic?
Well, I don't know. And so a recovered alcoholic, I'd have no problem. They were off of that. But an alcoholic, you're in the state, and there's some repentance and stuff in between there now. How do you handle something like that? I mean, I was just wondering or something.
Okay, first of all, I want to make clear that once an alcoholic, as far as we know, always an alcoholic. There is no cure. The recovery simply means that a person learns to live life comfortably and productively without alcohol. Okay. What I hear, let me see, you're asking me, what about communing a person who is a practicing alcoholic but who's working with it and who does feel sincere repentance? Okay, I'm not. Okay, where are you on that?
Well, I that's what I was wondering. I just don't know. For me, it's a touchy question there. He's only living in sin once in a while. You know, he's trying to deal with the illness itself. But still, when I'm getting bombed, you know, that certainly isn't...
My experience is that most alcoholics are not coming to communion. I don't think you're going to run into that problem very often. If they are, their religious life is probably, except for these lucid moments and moments of repentance, their spiritual life is probably fairly bankrupt. Footnote to that. Imagine what it's like to be a clergyman and to be an alcoholic and to have to continue to go through all of the motions of religion. That's and by the way, until a few months ago, the rate of alcoholism among the clergy was the highest of the professions. The medical profession has now come to lead the way over us again. I wouldn't doubt it. I didn't answer your question. I just want you to know. I want you to know. I know I didn't. I don't. Again, you know, that's where it's important that you are a sensitive, informed, and caring pastor. You know, I don't think there are any answers to that.
What do you think of that renowned report that says alcoholics can have a drink once in a while?
I don't think I believe that. If the word got out that I did, I have a few colleagues that would probably put a contract out on me. No, I don't believe it. You know, there may be exceptions, but I wouldn't want to teach that to anybody. I wouldn't want to promise that. Is that it? I think our time's about
great.
Thank you very much. It's been good.